3 weeks ago, his wife had a baby and almost died. So she had hemorrhaging, bleeding. So very fit, a very healthy young woman. But you know, pregnancy is even today, you know, deadly for too many women. She's recovering now, but after a couple weeks in the hospital and loss of a lot of blood and still a lot of weakness, and you know, there was no reason to anticipate this. So these kinds of things can strike us out of the blue. And so, you know, Kwanzaa Mbosong to her. In this, you know, this fits into our story today, as I'll get to. A couple things I'd say about the early Buddhist teachings. You know, in reading them, I think we often run into questions about, you know, the authenticity or projecting our own sorts of questions back onto them. And they have a mixture, like any documentation, any history, any literary creation, any journalism, any science, a mixture of different things in them. And I think the one thing that we see is they reflect the culture at the time. And so there are elements that clearly are just kind of taken for granted and form a basis of things that were in the air at the time. Teachings of reincarnation would be an example in, you know, Buddhist history. And so there's a reflection of the culture. There's also at the same time in the scriptures a progressive aspect that goes beyond that culture. And this is something obviously the Buddha, you know, demonstrated and maintained, something that was new and went beyond anything else. And so they reflect the culture and go beyond the culture. You know, some tension there, and we'll see tension in the stories today. These were oral teachings. They were remembered for hundreds of years. There's some recent scholarly work that suggests they were remembered actually quite well, better than we would perhaps dream that something could be remembered and preserved. That was a real skill that was developed at the time, and there's reasons to think that, you know, that they were preserved intact quite well for a long period of time. But at the same time, there's some imperfect sorts of things that come in over that. And you know, our history, the people who did the preservation and selected the things to preserve and remembered them, were not perfect people. These were monks. And so some degree of sexism, misogyny, other sorts of human flaws can creep into that. So we see all of that together. And our job today, I think, is not so much to pick and choose among that, but to see it. It's, I think, often easy for us to say, oh, you know, these people were primitive and they didn't know what they were doing, or, you know, we have the real insight and they, you know, had superstition that, you know, we can take out today in our wisdom. You know, I would really try to set all that aside as much as possible. And I think the point is, what can we learn? If we look closely, what we see is that these were real people, right? The world had colors then. It was not a black and white, not a simple thing, not a time of just, you know, ignorance that we have now overcome today. But, you know, it was a time of people just as human and just as alive as we are, just as many hopes and dreams and sorrows and sufferings and illnesses and, you know, all the things that we see today. Okay, so Maya and Mahapajapati were sisters, and I would say they were both mothers of the historic Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama. So Maya, these were in the Sakya kingdom, so in kind of southern Nepal, in northern India. These two sisters lived in a neighboring kingdom to where you know, the Buddha came from as a prince in the Sakya kingdom. And so the king, I guess when he became king, I don't know exactly what, and the history's a little vague, but Suddhodana wanted to find a wife and went to a neighboring kind of clan and found a wife. But they were polygamous often at the time. And so he married two sisters, Maya and Mahabajapati. Maya was the older sister, and Mahabajapati was the younger sister. So they married the king, came back to the kingdom, and after some amount of time, Maya was pregnant, and her clan at the time had a Lumbini grove, so a kind of secluded place in the forest where they would go to give birth. And so the women would, you know, get together and go to this place and kind of seclude themselves and have birth. And Siddhartha was born, but Maya was injured in labor, giving birth, and died 7 days later. So she never left the grove. And so there's the baby Buddha. Mahabajapati, her younger sister, was there with her, and Maya gave the Buddha to Mahabajapati to raise. So there was a transition from the birth mother to the woman who would be Buddha's mother for the rest of his life. In our sutras, this is sometimes referred to as a nursemaid. The Buddha was reared by a nursemaid or a maternal aunt. A maternal aunt, I guess, is correct in a certain sense, but I think both of those terms really downplay that after 7 days, his mother for the rest of his life was Mahabajapati. And she already had a one child at the time of her own. And so when her sister Maya died, Mahabajapati became the queen of the kingdom. So she was now the elder wife. She became the head of all the women, the harem, as it would be called. So different consorts, but also much of the operational aspects of the kingdom. She became the mother to this baby that she hadn't intended. And she gave up one of her own child, I believe it was a daughter, her own eldest child. That child then went to a nursemaid so that Mahabajapati could nurse Siddhartha, and so her sister's baby. So, and her sister died, who was her closest friend in her life. And so all of this change just, you know, was immediately thrust upon her, from being the youngest sister to now being, you know, one of the most powerful women in this kingdom and having her own life completely upended. I'm going to hand out, I've got a handout, and I think online this can be shared as a PDF. Poems from Maya and Mahabajapati. And the one from Mahabajapati is in the Therigatha. We'll look at that second. The one from Maya is in an oral tradition in Cambodia, and it was collected in a wonderful book by Wendy Garling, called "The Woman Who Raised the or the Women Who Raised the Buddha," and actually the woman who raised the Buddha, but it was women, two mothers, and Debbie, if you would hand those around, thank you. And I'll read the first poem and have a couple of comments once these go around. So the song, this was a death song, or death poem, from Maya, the birth mother of the Buddha. And she said, "Little sister Gotami." So first of all, Gotami, so Buddha's Gotama. So this is kind of a clan name. So Gotami is referring to Mahabajapati here as a feminine word. So little sister Gotami, hold to these words of guidance. I now ask you to receive. Little sister, forgive me. Since giving birth to my son, only 7 days have passed. My life withers to nothing as I pass on to the next world. What can I do when we are born only to be destroyed? All humans and animals die and decay by nature. Never lasting, never sure, life is as the Pali phrase, anicchum, dukkham, anatta. Little darling, you must know. Now as for me, dear sister, don't worry, for death is sure. No more can I hold my son, the refuge of gods and men. You who pity your sister, you lovely girl, that is why I ask you to hug and hold this motherless child of mine. Nurse him and bathe his body, attend to him day and night, care for him like no other. Oh, my golden girl, don't stop. This is just incredibly powerful and emotional here. A few things that I'll point out in this poem. She says, all humans and animals die and decay by nature. So this brings to mind the five remembrances, under which Paul just gave a Dharma talk on recently. I'm of the nature to grow old. I'm of the nature to die. I'm of the nature to have ill health. All things, you know, that we have and all relationships will be taken from us. And our actions are a continuation. Those are the five remembrances. But you know, these are coming in here. Ill health, death, dying, decaying. And she's remembering that and passing that on to her sister. But not only that, right? She's also passing on life. There's this baby. So care for him like no other. So engage in this caring. She says, life is as the Pali phrase, anicchum, dukkham, and anatta. So these are the three marks of existence here. Impermanence, we often say, suffering, and no self or non-self. I might translate these slightly differently. Impermanence, everything changes. Dukkham, instead of suffering, perhaps everything is unsatisfactory in the end. Nothing's ever 100% satisfactory. We don't get to that point. And anatta, the non-self, is that, you know, the self changes too. It's part of this, you know, kind of change and dissatisfactory part. So an interesting thing here, we have no idea of knowing, you know, the extent to which these marks of impermanence were taught at the time. The song is telling us that the core parts of our teaching, the five remembrances and the marks of impermanence, came to the Buddha from his birth mother to her sister, from his mother to his mother who reared him, and then presumably to him. And so this is really setting up a lineage here in this tradition of how much of this teaching came to us from the Buddha's mothers here, which is, I think, you know, very powerful. And at the end, she says, I ask you to hug and hold this motherless child of mine, and refers to him as the refuge of gods and men. Now, the song was no doubt somewhat retroactively put together. And we don't know the history of that. But if we just take it on the face, the really interesting thing about it is she's saying, this child is the refuge of gods and men and women. Hug and hold, this child is motherless. Attend to him day and night and don't stop. But she could not have known at the time, as a matter of historic fact, that this child would be the Buddha. There's stories of premonitions and prophecies and this sort of thing. But I think what it really shows us is this child, any child right here, is the Buddha. And so she is a child. This child is a refuge of gods and men. The child that was born to my friend 3 weeks ago is a refuge of gods and men. Every child is part of the same Buddha nature. Every child, to some extent, is motherless or could be motherless. Every child also has a mother, is a mother. So we see all of these things together in this story. And what, you know, to the five remembrances, which actions are our continuation? To hug, to hold, to love them, to share in death, perhaps, and give them up, or to adopt them, and to continue that. So that's what Maya was teaching us and teaching her sister and teaching her son. Okay, so Mahapajapati raised the Buddha, and there's all many stories of the Buddha as a child, as a youth, as the prince, as having a wife, perhaps more than one wife, probably had at least one younger wife in addition to the elder wife, so being raised in this, and then deciding to leave that and go out to seek the path. And at that time, Mahapajapati was instrumental in trying to stop him from doing this. So she didn't want him to leave. She was the queen. Part of her job was to have, you know, the next generation and preserve this dynasty and the power and the riches here. And she ran the harem. There are stories that she tried to, you know, keep the prince here. He, you know, liked women. And so she could kind of, you know, try to produce attachments to keep him on the path that he was on, his leadership, but he left. As we know. Anyway, and then years, you know, a couple decades later, the king died. And so she was left as being, you know, the queen, and presumably there was another king. I don't know the story, but she was, I guess, the queen. There's some name for it. But anyway, the former queen. And but her son was the Buddha at this time, and had a large following. And she started practicing this path, as did a number of members of the royal family and many others at the time. And she was now free from maintaining the kingdom and all of this, and went and asked the Buddha, said, "Yeah, I want to become a nun. And so can I ordain?" There were no nuns at the time. So she said, "All these men follow you. You've got all these monks, hundreds of them. They go with you, you're teaching them. I want to do that too." And he said, "No." So, "I'm sorry." And she said, "Well, can I practice? Can I ordain? Can I do this?" He said, "No, you can't ordain. But you can wear the robes, and you can shave your head, and you can practice, but we're not going to do ordination. That's not for women. That's for men." And so the son that she had, you know, raised her whole life, he's there saying, "Nope, Mom, you're outside. You can dress the part, and you can practice for sure, but not join the order." So she shaved her head and got the robes, and many other women followed her. The stories say 500 women followed her, and they shaved their heads, and they put on robes, and they followed behind the Buddha and as he would go teaching from one town to another, and they would follow along. She went and asked him again, "We're here, we're following you, we've shaved our heads, we're practicing, surely we're doing as much as any of these men. And can we be ordained?" And he said, "No, no." She went to his assistant, Ananda, who is said to be a cousin, first cousin of the Buddha. Some stories suggest he might have been a son of the Buddha by the second wife. We don't know. But she went to Ananda, who was his, you know, assistant, basically. And asked Ananda, "Well, doesn't the Buddha teach that all sentient beings can be enlightened, including women?" And I said, "Yes, he does. So we women are just as much in practice to give and to gain and to engage in as any man, surely. And Ananda said, yes, you do. She said, well, go argue that with him. He's not going to listen to me. So go and bring that up. So Ananda did and went to the Buddha and said, you know, you teach all beings can be enlightened. This is true. Yes, it's true. Would that include women? Yes, it would. So women can be enlightened. Yes, they can. So why can't they be ordained? And the Buddha said, finally, okay, they can. And so Mahaprajapati got ordination then from the Buddha. And then she was given the authority to ordain other women. And that was the start of the lineage of women in the order of women monastics. It continues today. It's believed in fact, by some scholars that the women's order today throughout the world has been unbroken in a way that the male monastic order has not. So the women's order is more continuous and more kind of historically intact all the way back to Mahaprajapati than perhaps the men's orders are today. But one of the conditions the Buddha had was that the nuns would be subject to the men. So you're going to be, when there's an ordination, there must be a male monastic present. When you're seated in the hall, any man, no matter how junior, will be seated ahead of any woman, no matter how senior. So there are a number of these monastic rules that were put in place that in parts of the world still are still in place in women's orders today. This is very controversial. It should be in my view. And this creates one of the places where I think when we look back on these stories, we see this conflict between progressivism, between our own thoughts, between the culture at the time. And it's very easy to look at this and say, you know, the Buddha kind of didn't get it, and it took a while for him to, you know, to realize this and to change this thing. But there was another thing going on at the time, which was that society, put quite apart from anything involving the Buddha and his teachings, society put women in a place where they were expected to be subject to men. In supposedly at the time, if a woman was not under the control of a man, she was regarded as being up for grabs, as it were, so being sexually available to anyone, could be claimed by anyone, and needed to be, you know, under the authority of a male leader. And so when we look back at this and see what was up with the Buddha saying no, it was probably that he was wrestling with this. If she comes out of the protection of the royal family, or these other women come out of the protections of their husbands or brothers, or whatever it may be, they're going to be unprotected. In this society, this is not possible in this society. And I imagine probably wrestled within the stories tell us, had to do this multiple times until he finally said, okay, I think we have a solution here. You know, the women can come and be ordained, but they're going to be under the protection of my entire Sangha, which was men at the time. And so he created a way of saying, okay, we can do this thing and we can keep it in a way that's, you know, aligned with society, but instead of being under their husbands or their brothers or whoever, they can be under our entire Sangha. And so now women are welcome to that. And they're going to be protected by all of us, not just their brother or their husband or their king. They're going to be protected by my hundreds or thousands of monks and me. And this is how we're going to have this evolution in society. And so one way to look at this is that that's incredibly progressive. It was responsive to a very different role and a very different place in society at the time. Would we look at it today and say it's what we do? Of course not. It's not what we would do today. And our society is very different today. But I think it was, you know, it was quite a leap forward at the time. And so I think that was, you know, that was one of the things we see here. Okay, so let's take a look at Mahapajapati's poem from the Tirugatha. This was when she was older and near death. It says, Buddha, hero, praise be to you. You foremost among all beings, you who have released me from pain, and so many other beings too. All suffering has been understood. The source of craving has withered. Cessation has been touched by me on the Noble Eightfold Path. I've been mother and son before, and father, brother, grandmother too. Not understanding what was real, I flowed on without finding peace. But now I've seen the Blessed One. This is my last compounded form. The onflowing of birth has expired. There's no more re-becoming now. See the gathering of followers, putting forth effort, self-controlled, always with strong resolution. This is how to honor the Buddhas. Surely for the good of so many did Maya give birth to Gotama. He bursts asunder the mass of pain of those stricken by sickness and death. A couple of comments here. Gerald Seminatore, a couple weeks ago, talked about mythological women ancestors and this kind of changing of gender that we see in many of those stories. And we see that here. So she says, I've been mother and son, father, brother, grandmother. So over time in this traditional teaching of reincarnation, every person goes through every kind of a being that there is, human and otherwise, and she's calling this out. And I think you know, even regardless of kind of the views that one might have about reincarnation, I think one way we can look at this is that this existence of all of us is one kind of existence, one kind of human mind, and it shows up in different forms. It shows up as men, women, fathers, brothers, kings, queens, consorts, you know, outcasts, whatever it may be. But it's all together, and all of us share in this same experience. And she says further, there's no more re-becoming now. And one way that I like to think of this in our Zen practice, again, setting aside kind of metaphysics and questions of, you know, reincarnation and whatever, it's that all of us in struggling with what we do day to day, struggling with our suffering, struggling with society and our place in it, every one of us from birth is re-becoming constantly. Right? I go in, you know, to here, I'm practicing in one way, I go to work, I'm doing something different, I go home, I'm doing something different. We adopt all of these different roles, and we do this largely with anxiety. How should I behave here? How could it be? How are other people seeing me? Like, what do I need to do? Am I doing the right thing? Oh my God, I did this wrong thing. Right, we have all of this all the time. And so the no more re-becoming, our practice is saying, you know, just, you could be just right here, right? So that re-becoming, that, you know, this, and worrying about this, and taking on this role, and doing this thing, and trying to manipulate this prince so he'll stay here with the harem, and it's just, right, the no more re-becoming cuts through that. And that's what she's saying here. Then how does this happen? She's teaching us how this happens. Putting forth effort, self-control, strong resolution. She doesn't say living with perfection or having perfect insight or attaining the 32 marks and flying up to the heavens. No, she's saying, you take the baby, you raise the baby, you honor my sister Maya, who gave birth, comes in the final paragraph. You put forth effort, You have self-control. You have strong resolution. So in our tradition, we call this try mind. Just try, try, try. And she says, this is how to honor the Buddhas. First today, beyond that, I would call out three other lessons here from Maha Pajapati and from her sister Maya. So the first is this: persist, right? If there's something that you know is right, or stopping something that is wrong. So for her, it was finding a way to have full kind of equality in the Dharma and ordination for women. And she persisted. So persist. Second is, along the way, you can adopt the role. So in the recovery, they often say, fake it till you make it. And so this is a thing too. You can do it, even if you feel like an imposter, even if it feels imperfect, even if it feels like it's not going to work. So she shaved her heads, put on the robes, and that's fine. So you can adopt the role and practice and do the best you can along the way. And the final thing, what she did, and this happens today, every single week, I see an example of this, in my personal life or at work or somewhere else, which is finding allies. So for whatever reason, the Buddha kept saying no to her, even after she adopted the role and even after she persisted, and she found an ally, Ananda. And paired with that is being an ally. So Ananda, maybe the younger generation, he was able to see new possibilities in this story. And the story tells us that's how change occurs. That's how change occurred, even for the Buddha, which was learning from the next generation and learning from the previous generation, his mother. And so that's fine. You had kind of the generation before and the generation after got together and had an intervention. And that's wonderful. That's how change occurs. And that's why I think we remember her still today. So I'll stop there. Thank you for coming today.